What if the meditation app on your phone, right? The one you just religiously log into to de-stress from your exhausting, I don't know, 60-hour work week. What if that app is actually part of the reason you're so burned out?
Right. Yeah, it's a terrifying thought.
It really is, because think about it for a second. We usually treat this feeling of deep exhaustion like it's a simple battery issue. Like you plug yourself in, you get some rest, maybe you drink a green smoothie, and the little battery icon in your brain just turns green again.
Yeah, we frame it entirely as an energy problem.
Exactly. But then, you look at the world right now, and you consider this underlying sense of dread you might have had recently, and you realize it's an exhaustion not just from your job or your daily tasks, but from the very things that are supposed to heal you.
Which is the worst kind of exhaustion,
And
honestly.
it's the rigid religious dogmas that just leave you feeling hollowed out. Or the hyper-commodified wellness culture, selling you $70 candles to fix systemic
Yeah.
anxieties.
Or those meditation apps that, if we're being completely honest, just feel like productivity hacks designed to make you work harder for a system that is grinding you to dust.
Yes. Suddenly, that whole battery metaphor is completely broken. We aren't just drained. We are trapped in a landscape that is deeply, fundamentally murky. So today, we are looking at a paper that argues the modern cures for our exhaustion might actually be weapons keeping us trapped in it.
It's the absolute definition of a systemic crisis, and it's a brilliant place to start because what you're describing is the realization that the lifeboats we've been sold are actually made of lead.
Wow, yeah, lifeboats made of lead.
Right. We are finding that the cures are actively participating in the disease. We've just lost contact with the ground of what actually sustains us, replacing it with an imitation of healing.
Exactly. And so, what if our entire concept of spirituality has been turned upside down? Welcome to our deep dive. We are so thrilled you are joining us today.
Really glad to be here for this one.
Our mission today is to explore a groundbreaking 2026 academic white paper by Dr. Bechara Saile. It is titled Life Coherent Spirituality: Reverence, Love, and Responsibility in the Worlds We Can Serve.
It's a heavy title, but it's so good.
So good. And our goal today is to really figure out how to reconnect our reverence for the sacred with actual, messy, lived responsibility.
And we need to establish the foundation here carefully, I think, because Dr. Saile is making a massive paradigm-shifting claim right out of the gate.
Yeah, he doesn't hold back.
No, not at all. We are currently facing this incredible web of interconnected crises, right?
Yeah.
Ecological, social, political, health, you see it everywhere.
Oh, climate destabilization, the
Yeah,
inequality.
total erosion of public trust, an absolute epidemic of chronic disease and mental distress.
Yeah.
And the paper argues that we desperately need to stop treating these as isolated technical
Like
failures.
it's just a broken pipe we can patch.
Exactly. They are fundamentally entangled with a spiritual crisis. We are facing a crisis of meaning because our spiritual models, the ways we make sense of our existence and our obligations to one another, well, they have become completely detached from the actual living ground that makes life possible.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because to understand what Dr. Saile means by life-coherent spirituality, we first have to understand what it isn't.
Right. We have to look at the disease first.
Yeah, and the paper introduces this core diagnostic concept called the great spiritual inversion. The author argues that this inversion happens when derivative abstractions are placed above the living ground they're supposed to serve.
Yes.
We're talking about things like doctrine, purity, institutional survival, money, power. It's like, okay, think of it like having a beautiful, intricate, hand-drawn map of a forest.
I love this analogy.
Right, and you are so obsessed with worshiping the map and cleaning the map and arguing with people over the exact color of the ink on the map that you don't even notice you are actively setting the actual physical forest on fire to keep the room warm.
Yes, you are literally burning the territory to worship the map.
The symbol is mistaken for the sacred, and the actual secret, the living world, is destroyed in the name of the symbol.
That analogy gets right to the heart of it. Because the symbol, the map, was originally created to help you navigate and appreciate the
It
forest.
was supposed to be a tool.
Exactly. But the inversion happens when the map becomes the idol. And what's truly fascinating here, and honestly quite terrifying, is the subtle danger of this inversion.
How so?
Well, it doesn't usually require explicit malice. People don't wake up in the morning, rub their hands together, and decide to be spiritually destructive.
Right, like cartoon villains.
Right. It happens through a very gradual uncoupling of our ideals from our material reality. For instance, think of a spiritual practice meant to cultivate humility, say, fasting or taking a vow of poverty.
Okay.
Originally, that practice is designed to break down the ego so you can connect more deeply with others, to share their hunger, right? But slowly, over generations or even just years, it becomes a marker of superiority. Like, I fast more strictly than you, therefore I am closer to the divine.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Or consider a religious doctrine meant to protect a community's shared meaning. Over time, it just becomes a weapon to exclude and punish people who suffer differently than you do.
So the tool designed to open your heart literally becomes the armor you use to shut the world out.
Precisely. And this is why the paper gives us a primary diagnostic question. This is something you, as a listener, can apply directly to your own life right now. You have to ask, what does this spirituality make possible?
What does it make possible?
Yes. Look past the aesthetics. Look past the ancient texts. What does it actually generate in the material world? Does it make truth, tenderness, and structural repair possible? Or does it make denial, shame, and domination easier?
That question really stops you in your tracks, doesn't it? What does it make possible? Because it completely strips away the aesthetics of spirituality.
Nope.
Like, it doesn't matter if the chanting sounds beautiful, or if the yoga studio has perfect ambient lighting, or if the robes the priest is wearing look incredibly ancient and holy. What is it actually making possible in the real world?
Right. Is it building a community, or is it building an exclusionary club?
Exactly. And when you apply that lens to the state of our modern world, it gets pretty grim. I mean, we have unprecedented power as a species.
Oh, beyond anything our ancestors could imagine.
Yeah, we have artificial intelligence that can write symphonies, gene editing that can alter biology, spacecraft, instant global communication. But we often feel completely devoid of wisdom.
Yes. And if we extrapolate on that disconnect between power and wisdom, we can see how technically advanced civilizations can remain profoundly spiritually immature.
Ooh. Say more about that.
Think about it. If a society has immense technological power but lacks answerability to lifelike, if it hasn't developed the spiritual capacity to care for the vulnerable or the foresight to protect the ecological commons, that technological power just accelerates the great inversion.
It just makes the burning of the forest faster.
Exactly. We optimize the systems of extraction. We use AI to figure out how to extract oil faster,
yeah,
or how to keep eyeballs glued to rage-inducing content for ad revenue.
Right. The intellect is highly developed.
Yeah.
But the reverence is completely inverted.
The living ground collapses under the weight of our cleverness.
Wow. And because this inversion is so subtle, so deeply woven into the fabric of our daily lives and our institutions, we really need to break down exactly how it manifests.
Yeah, we need to look at the symptoms.
The paper categorizes this into specific forms of what it calls life-blind spirituality. It details 8 distinct faces of this inversion. And looking at the first one, it's something I think is deeply ingrained in a lot of Western thought. It's this idea of escaping from the world.
Right, the great escape.
Yeah. It's the belief that the physical body, the earth, the dirt, the messiness of biology is essentially just a prison, or at best a disposable stage. The ultimate spiritual goal is to get out, to transcend, leave the messiness behind, and go to some pure ethereal realm.
It's the belief that mortality itself is proof of our spiritual inferiority.
That's a great way to put it.
And the danger here is entirely practical. Because if you see the earth as just a temporary inconvenience, like a waiting room before the real show starts in the afterlife, then you have absolutely no spiritual obligation to protect its ecology.
Right. Why fix the plumbing in a hotel room you're checking out of tomorrow?
Exactly. If you see the human body as a trap for the soul, you have no spiritual obligation to honor its limits, to ensure everyone has health care, or to care for its illnesses. Transcendence, in this life-blind model, becomes a refusal of incarnation.
A refusal of incarnation.
Yeah, it's an abdication of your responsibility to the place you actually exist.
And if you see the world as something to just be used and discarded, that bleeds directly into another psychological trap Dr. Saley identifies, which is the sanctification of domination.
This one is incredibly pervasive.
It really is.
Mm-hmm.
This is where sacred language is actively used to legitimize hierarchy, exclusion, or colonial conquest. It's the idea that some people or some nations are naturally closer to the sacred than others, and therefore their control over the quote-unquote lesser people or the wild land is actually a divine right.
Right.
We've seen this historically with things like manifest destiny, but it happens today in more subtle ways, right?
Oh, absolutely. This is perhaps the most dangerous form of spiritual incoherence because of how it operates on the human mind. It literally colonizes the conscience.
How so?
Well, think about the mechanics of this. It teaches the vulnerable, the marginalized, to interpret their own diminishment as a form of obedience or spiritual maturity.
Like God has placed me in this subservient role, and accepting it is my spiritual test.
Exactly. And simultaneously, it teaches those with power and wealth to experience their control as righteousness. Like, I am wealthy and powerful because I'm favored by the divine.
Oh, that is so twisted.
It is a completely sealed, self-justifying loop that makes cruelty appear sacred. When domination is sanctified, any resistance to oppression is framed not just as a political crime, but as a sin against the universe.
That is heavy. And it makes me think of how, in some circles, there's this intense obsession with purity, which is another face of this life-blind spirituality.
Yes, the purity spiral.
This brings up something I see all the time, especially in modern wellness spaces, this absolute obsession with detoxing, eating perfectly clean, or staying away from low-vibe people.
Well, managing your vibe.
Exactly. It feels like a defense mechanism. A tradition or a culture starts to value separation from contamination way more than it values compassion or healing. The pure must be defended from the impure at all costs.
And the fundamental problem with an obsession with purity is that life, by its very definition, is inherently messy. It is porous. Bodies leak. They hunger. They age. They fail. They decompose. Communities are morally complex and full of friction. When a spirituality or a wellness culture becomes obsessed with purity, it becomes what the papal calls anti-incarnational.
Wait. Anti-incarnational, meaning against the very fact that we are in physical bodies.
Exactly. It's a rejection of the flesh and the reality of the physical world. It produces a profound disgust toward vulnerability. Think about how diet culture often uses moral language. Foods are good or sinful. Your body is clean or toxic.
I see that language every single day online.
Right. And it creates a hostility toward repair. Because to repair something, to actually heal a person or a society, you have to make contact with what is broken. You have to touch the wound.
Yeah, you have to get your hands dirty.
Exactly. If your primary goal is to remain pure and uncontaminated, you will never reach into the muck to pull someone out. You will just stand on the clean shore and judge them for drowning.
Man. But hold on, I really need to push back on this next part, because the paper brings up a concept that I think a lot of people listening, including myself, might struggle with.
Okay, let's hear it.
It talks about spiritual bypassing. It describes this as using concepts like forgiveness, acceptance, or inner peace prematurely in order to avoid unresolved pain, injustice, or moral responsibility.
Right.
But wait, isn't finding inner peace and letting go of attachments the literal point of many major philosophical and spiritual traditions?
Well, yes and no.
I mean, if I'm meditating to let go of the blazing anger I have toward an unfair boss or a broken political system, is that bypassing? How do you, as a listener, know if you are genuinely transcending a problem or just using spirituality to hide from it? Where is the line?
That is a phenomenal question, and it represents a tension almost everyone who pursues any kind of personal growth feels.
Yeah, it's confusing.
The paper clarifies this beautifully, and the distinction is all about the return. This raises an important question, right? A life-coherent spirituality absolutely does not deny the need for interior freedom. You need practices to regulate your nervous system.
You can't just be angry all the time.
Exactly. You need to let go of obsessive anger so it doesn't consume you. But, and this is the crux of it, transcendence must return as deeper responsibility for incarnation.
Okay, unpack that return for me. What does that look like?
True transcendence frees you from your egoic compulsions. Your need to be right, your petty grievances, your paralyzing fear, it frees you from that so that you can actually care more about the world.
Oh, okay.
It strips away the noise so you become more available, more courageous, and more effective in helping the vulnerable. You let go of the anger at your boss, not so you can tolerate an abusive workplace, but so you can calmly and strategically organize a union or find a healthier job without destroying yourself from the inside out in the process.
I see. So the peace is a tool for action, not a replacement for it.
Exactly. Spiritual bypass, on the other hand, just insulates you in your own serenity. It uses the language of peace to build a fortress wall between you and the suffering of others, or even your own deep-seated trauma.
Right.
You forgive someone who is actively abusing you without demanding justice or boundaries, which just enables the harm to continue. You look at systemic poverty and say, well, everything happens for a reason. We just need to send them light and love.
Yeah, sending good vibes instead of actually helping.
Exactly. That isn't transcendence. That is anesthesia.
That is such a crucial distinction. It's the difference between, like, rising above the maze to see the whole picture so you can help others find the exit versus tying balloons to your chair and floating away so you don't have to look at the people stuck in the maze anymore.
That's a perfect analogy.
And honestly, that kind of bypassing connects perfectly to how these practices get bought and sold. It leads right into spirituality as a commodity, which is the next phase of inversion. We are watching ancient, rigorous practices get turned into branded, monetized lifestyle enhancements.
Yeah.
It privatizes suffering.
Yes, this is the engine of wellness capitalism.
Oh, absolutely.
It takes the vast human longing for communion, for meaning, and compresses it into an individualized product. And the most insidious part is the narrative it sells. It tells you that structural violence is just a personal growth challenge.
What does that actually look like in practice, though?
Imagine you are burning out. You are exhausted because your workplace demands 80 hours a week. You have no paid family leave. Your rent takes up 60% of your income, and you have no social safety net.
Which is the reality for so many people.
Exactly. You are experiencing the predictable biological results of structural violence. But the commodified spiritual answer, the advertisement you see on your feed, tells you that the problem is your mindset.
Right. You just need to meditate better.
You need to buy this $500 weekend retreat. You need a better morning routine. It takes the blame entirely off the life-damaging systems and places it squarely on your shoulders as a consumer.
So if you're still stressed, you just haven't bought enough wellness yet.
You haven't optimized yourself enough.
It's like putting a Band-Aid on a bullet wound, selling the Band-Aid for $50 and then telling the person bleeding that they just aren't applying the Band-Aid with enough mindfulness.
That is exactly it.
Which actually feeds into another massive problem Dr. Saheli points out regarding how we view peace. He talks about false peace. This is the idea of preserving harmony by silencing suffering.
Yes.
It's asking the harmed party to just move on and be the bigger person before the harm has even been acknowledged, let alone repaired, just to keep things comfortable for the group.
False peace is just managed violence. It values the appearance of calm over the reality of truth.
It really is.
Think about a family dynamic where one person is deeply toxic or abusive, but the rest of the family pressures the victim to stay quiet at Thanksgiving dinner just to keep the peace.
Right. Don't ruin the holiday.
The peace they are keeping only exists for the enablers. For the victim, it is an active state of psychological warfare. If a community, a nation, or a family is celebrating unity, but some groups within that system are still bearing the hidden costs of exclusion, deprivation, or abuse, that is not peace. That is pacification.
Pacification, yeah.
It is demanding that the oppressed suffer in silence so the privileged don't have to feel uncomfortable.
It reminds me, without getting preachy, of what Martin Luther King Jr. wrote about the white moderate who preferred a negative peace, which is the absence of tension, to a positive peace, which is the presence of justice.
Exactly. It's the exact same dynamic.
And that desire to maintain the status quo, to protect the comfort of the system, brings us to the issue of institutional self-preservation. This is when a spiritual organization, a church, a nonprofit, or a wellness brand prioritizes its reputation, its authority, and its finances over protecting the vulnerable people it claims to serve.
We see this so often.
We've seen this play out in the news so many times across various institutions. Covering up a massive scandal or protecting an abuser is deemed more important than caring for the victims, because if the truth gets out, the institution might lose funding or prestige. The institution becomes an idol that demands human sacrifice to maintain its image.
It is a tragic and recurring theme, and the paper suggests that the ultimate test of an institution's spiritual coherence is its capacity for institutional repentance.
Institutional repentance, what does that mean?
Well, an organization can hold profound wisdom, it can do great charitable work, it can carry traditions across generations, but if a spiritual institution cannot repent, if its leadership cannot admit when its internal structures or actions are actively disabling life, and then fundamentally change course to repair that harm, it is no longer answerable to life.
It's just answerable to its own survival.
At that point, it ceases to be a spiritual vessel and just becomes another corporation protecting its brand.
That makes perfect sense. And wrapping up these diagnostic phases of inversion, we have this concept of disembodied idealism, This is praising high, lofty ideals, like universal compassion or unconditional love, without providing the actual physical nervous system margins or the social conditions required to actually live those ideals out.
Because you cannot command someone into compassion. You cannot legislate empathy. Human beings are biological organisms.
We're not machines.
Right. For a person to consistently exhibit deep compassion and patience, they require relationships of safety, histories of care, and social conditions that don't keep their nervous systems in a chronic state of fight or flight.
Yeah, try being universally compassionate when you haven't slept and you can't pay rent.
Exactly. Disembodied idealism speaks beautifully from the pulpit about what we should be. We should be endlessly giving. We should never be angry. But it completely ignores the viability conditions of what we are. It demands the fruit while actively poisoning the roots of the tree.
Okay, so we spent a lot of time diagnosing the disease, the great spiritual inversion, and these various faces of life-blind spirituality, escaping the world, sanctifying domination, obsessed with purity, bypassing pain, commodifying wellness, enforcing false peace, protecting the institution over the victim, and demanding disembodied ideals.
Yeah, a heavy, heavy list.
It is. If that is the disease, what is the cure? How do we flip the map over and get back to the forest? This brings us to the paper's foundational solution, which is recognizing life itself as the ultimate sacred ground.
Yes, the pivot to life.
And the paper makes a crucial point here, that life cannot be reduced to just a biological mechanism or an economic resource. It is the fundamental condition through which all value, all meaning, and all spirituality arises. Before there can be a sacred text, before there can be a temple, before there can be an enlightenment experience, there must be breath.
There must be food.
Yes. There must be a world stable enough to conserve those things.
This is where we have to confront the deep modern disenchantment that stems from reducing life to mere mechanism. Modern biology and economics have given us incredible precision. We understand cellular pathways, we map the genome, we track global supply chains and GDP.
Sure, we have all the data.
But life, as it is actually lived, is experienced from the inside. It has a felt, relational dimension. When we reduce the human body to a machine that just needs its biochemical outputs optimized, or when we reduce an ancient forest to just board feet of timber, or when we look at an elder in our community and see only a healthcare cost liability, we lose the essence of living.
We just turn everything into spreadsheets.
We strip the world of its inherent value and start treating life as just dead material to be managed, extracted, and eventually discarded.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because I think a lot of people struggle to connect the abstract idea of value with the physical reality of biology. Think of life, the actual pulsating, breathing reality of ecosystems and human bodies, as the hardware and the operating system of a computer.
Okay, I like this.
Your values, your ethics, your culture, your spiritual traditions, that's all the software. You can have the most beautiful, elegant, poetic software ever coded. But you cannot run the software if you are systematically taking a hammer to the hardware and corrupting the operating system.
That's brilliant.
If you don't have clean water, if the air is choked with smog, if a community's nervous system is constantly shattered by violence or poverty, you cannot run the compassion program. You cannot run the deep spiritual contemplation program. The hardware is crashing.
That analogy of the operating system is perfect because it illustrates that life is the enabling condition of value. Let's break that down. A stone does not suffer.
Right.
A stock market fluctuates, it crashes, it booms, but it doesn't grieve. A corporation doesn't feel pain. Value, ethics, and meaning only exist in the universe because living beings can be nourished or deprived, protected or harmed, loved or abandoned. Therefore, any spiritual system or political ideology that places its doctrines, its economic theories, or its symbols above the basic requirements of life is acting against its own ground. It is destroying the very foundation that allows it to exist in the first place.
I want you, the listener, to think about gratitude for a second. We hear about gratitude journals all the time, often as another one of those commodified wellness hacks to boost your mood.
Right. Write down three things you're grateful for and you'll be happy.
Yeah, exactly. But the paper has a profound, almost terrifying take on gratitude. It says gratitude isn't just politeness. It's not just saying thank you to the universe to get good karma. Gratitude is accurate perception.
Accurate perception.
It is looking at reality clearly. You did not create your own existence. Every single breath you take right now relies on the exact right composition of the Earth's atmosphere. Your digestion relies on microbial cycles you have no control over. Your body is the result of unbroken ancestral histories stretching back millions of years.
It's staggering when you really think about it.
You are not a self-made, isolated individual. You are an absolute node of interdependence.
And realizing that is the true beginning of life-coherent spirituality. It forcibly shifts you from an isolated self pursuing private salvation or personal optimization to a grateful participant in a vast, staggering web of conditions.
Yeah.
And because this web is living, it is deeply fragile, which brings us to a crucial epistemological shift in how we understand the world.
Epistemological shift, meaning a shift in how we actually know what is true.
Exactly. A shift in what we consider to be valid knowledge.
Yeah.
Once we deeply understand that life is an interconnected, fragile web, it completely changes how we view vulnerability, how we gather knowledge, and how we define healing. The paper states that life is sacred because it is vulnerable, not because it is invulnerable.
That feels counterintuitive. Usually we associate the sacred with things that are eternal, unchanging, indestructible, like a diamond or a god that can't be harmed.
That is the old inverted model. In a life-coherent model, to live is to be open to the world. You have to take in food, air, water, and relationship.
You have to interact.
If you seal an organism off completely to protect it from all harm, it dies. Vulnerability is the prerequisite for existence. Therefore, healing isn't just symptom reduction. It isn't just taking a pill to make the pain go away so you can get back to work.
Right.
Healing is the restoration of coherence between the organism and the world it lives in.
Let's make that concrete. What does organism-world coherence look like in everyday life?
Think about what this means practically for our healthcare systems. A person can be medically treated in a clinic. Their biochemistry can be perfectly adjusted with a pharmaceutical intervention. The symptoms are gone.
Technically, they are cured.
Technically. But if they are then sent back out into the exact conditions that generated the illness in the first place, say, severe housing precarity, living next to a polluting factory, or crushing social isolation, they are not healed. The coherence between them and their world is still fundamentally broken.
The environment is still actively dismantling their biology.
Yes. The paper radically expands the definition of healing to include justice, ecological repair, and truthful speech. Because a polluted river is a health crisis, and a society built on lies shatters the nervous system.
Just imagine what modern medicine or therapy would look like if it fully adopted this organism world coherence model. The boundaries between professions would completely blur.
Completely.
A doctor couldn't just look at a patient's chart or prescribe a statin. They'd have to look at the city's air quality, the availability of fresh food in that zip code, the walkability of the streets. A therapist couldn't just look at a client's childhood trauma. They'd have to look at the economic stressors crushing their client, the gig economy, instability, the lack of childcare.
It changes the whole scope of care.
The doctor, the ecologist, the urban planner, the social worker, and the spiritual guide would essentially realize they're all working on the exact same project, restoring the conditions for life to flourish.
They would all be practitioners of life coherence. And what's beautiful about this framework is that it protects medicine from becoming purely reductionist, treating people like broken machines on an assembly line, and it protects spirituality from magical thinking.
Yeah, no more blaming a chronic autoimmune illness on a person's lack of positive vibes.
Exactly. And you don't reduce healing to biochemical correction alone. You treat the whole living relational system.
So if life is the sacred ground, and we acknowledge that we are completely embedded in this vulnerable, interdependent web, how do we actively interact on that ground? How do we treat each other in a way that respects that web?
Well, this brings us to the relational operation of spiritual coherence, which Dr. Saley identifies as love.
But we have to be careful here because the word love has been diluted into meaninglessness.
Yeah.
The paper draws heavily on the brilliant Chilean biologist and philosopher Humberto Maturana. And Maturana radically redefines love. He says love is not sentimentality. It's not just affection or emotional warmth or getting butterflies in your stomach. Maturana defines love as the relational domain in which another being is allowed to appear as legitimate in coexistence.
This is a massive paradigm shift in how we view human interaction. Let's contrast it with what we usually mistake for love. Sentimentality is feeling without responsibility.
Ooh, feeling without responsibility.
Sentimentality feels warm. It can even bring tears to your eyes, but it is ultimately self-protective and passive. Love, in this biological and spiritual framework, is the actual active opening of a space where another being is not reduced.
Right.
It is the space where you refuse to reduce them to an object, a threat, a category, a demographic, or a tool for your own use. It's the space where their reality, their internal experience, fundamentally matters.
Well, hold on, I need to stop you there. I hear legitimacy and coexistence, and my brain immediately goes to the extremes. Does allowing someone's legitimacy mean we just approve of everything they do?
Not at all.
What if they're doing active harm to others? What if we are talking about a criminal or a political dictator or an abuser? Does love mean we just let them do whatever they want because they are legitimate?
What's fascinating here, and this is where Maturana's work is so rigorous, is that legitimacy absolutely does not mean permission for harm, nor does it abolish boundaries. It simply means you refuse to delete their status as a human being in your own mind.
Okay, so you still hold them accountable.
You can resist someone's actions vigorously. You can and should enforce strict boundaries. You can hold them legally accountable. You can imprison them if they are a danger to society, but you do not dehumanize them.
Because the moment you dehumanize them, you've broken the web yourself.
Exactly. Dehumanization is the ultimate spiritual incoherence. It is the withdrawal of love at the ontological level, meaning at the very core of their existence, you are saying, you are not real, you do not count.
Wow.
Once you withdraw legitimacy, anything can be justified. Neglect, exploitation, torture, genocide, they all begin with the exact same premise, which is this other group is not fully legitimate in coexistence with us. They're pests, they're animals, they're disease. Refusing to cross that line into dehumanization, even when fighting terrible injustice, is the hardest spiritual work there is.
The paper has a great example comparing sentimentality to this deeper definition of love, especially when it comes to social issues. It says sentimentality loves the image of the poor, but does nothing to change the conditions of poverty.
Yes.
It watches a documentary, feels a deep pang of pity, maybe cries a little, and then turns off the TV and walks away feeling like a good person simply for having felt sad.
Because feeling sad feels like doing something.
Exactly. But love is the courage to actually participate in changing the material conditions that allow life to flourish. Love is life-serving fidelity under real, difficult conditions.
Love is not just softness. Sometimes love has to be incredibly courageous. It has to confront. It has to tell the uncomfortable truth. It has to demand that resources be redistributed, but it does so without contempt. It fights to conserve a world where dignity and mutual recognition remain possible, even for the opponent.
But love can't just remain a one-on-one interpersonal dynamic, right? I mean, I can treat my neighbor with legitimacy, but if the bank forecloses on their house unfairly or the water supply in our town is poisoned, my interpersonal love isn't enough to save them.
Yeah, it's not.
It has to scale up. We have to figure out how to institutionalize this kind of love. And that brings us to the sociological and political aspects of the paper. The deep dive introduces two other major thinkers integrated into Dr. Saheeli's framework. First is Johann Galtung, the pioneer of peace and conflict studies. He brings in this essential concept of positive peace.
Galtung's work is critical for moving spirituality out of the private sphere and into the public square. He differentiates between negative peace and positive peace. Negative peace is just the absence of visible conflict.
Like we talked about earlier.
Right. The guns have stopped firing, or the protests have been cleared from the streets by the police. Everything looks quiet. But positive peace is the active presence of life-serving conditions. It's a society where justice, equity, and care are actually functioning.
So it's not just the absence of bad, it's the presence of good.
Exactly. And to help us understand why negative peace is often an illusion, Galtung breaks down violence into three categories: direct, structural, and cultural.
Let's walk through those with some concrete examples.
Yeah.
Direct violence is the obvious one.
Yes. Direct violence is a physical act. Someone punches someone else, a bomb is dropped, it wounds bodies visibly, and there is a clear perpetrator and a clear victim. But structural violence is much more insidious. It is organized deprivation baked into the rules of society. It's unequal life chances, systemic poverty, a healthcare system tied to employment so that getting sick means going bankrupt. There's no single person pointing a gun, but the structure itself is disabling and killing people just as effectively.
And cultural violence is the story we tell ourselves to make both direct and structural violence seem okay.
Precisely. Cultural violence provides the spiritual, philosophical, or ideological justification that makes the structural violence seem normal, or deserved, or simply inevitable. It's the pervasive belief that poor people are just inherently lazy and deserve their poverty.
Or the belief that endless ecological extraction is just the necessary price of progress.
Cultural violence blinds us to structural violence.
So if you have a spirituality that constantly speaks of peace and love, but leaves structural and cultural violence completely unexamined and intact, that spirituality is basically a fraud.
It's totally hollow.
It's that false peace we talked about earlier. It's telling people to be calm while the ship sinks. And this is where the second major thinker comes in, the philosopher John McMurtry. He introduces something called the life value test and the concept of the civil commons. The paper frames the commons, our shared water, our air, the soil, our public health care, our public truth and education, as sacred vessels.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the paper insists that any political or economic system must be subjected to this life value test. And it is vital to note here that this framework is entirely impartial regarding traditional political tribes.
Yeah, that's an important point.
It does not matter if a system is draped in left-wing rhetoric of revolution or right-wing rhetoric of tradition. The test cuts through the ideological branding. The test is remarkably simple yet devastating. Does this institution, this policy, this economic system enable life capacity, or does it disable it?
Let's apply that. Say a local government is deciding whether to privatize a municipal hospital.
Right. You run it through the life value test. If the new institution enables life, say, by ensuring every single person in the community has access to preventative care and trauma treatment regardless of income, it is spiritually and practically coherent. It passes the test.
Okay.
But if the new institution disables life by closing the emergency room to cut costs, commodifying basic human needs to the point of exclusion, and letting people die of preventable diseases because they can't pay it, is structurally violent. It fails the test no matter how much profit it generates or what economic theory justifies it.
So what does this all mean for the listener? It means that advocating for clean water, demanding affordable health care, or fighting for ecological stability is not some secular political distraction from your quote-unquote real spiritual life.
It's not a side project.
It is not something you do outside of your spiritual practice. It is the very heart of spiritual responsibility. You cannot claim to be spiritually coherent if you are voting for, investing in, or silently complying with the destruction of the sacred vessels that keep everyone alive.
The civil commons are the shared conditions without which life cannot flourish. To protect them is an act of profound reverence. When we start viewing public health, education, and ecological stability not just as bureaucratic line items, but as sacred trusts, the arbitrary, artificial divide between our inner spiritual lives and our outer civic duties collapses.
It all becomes one thing.
Peace is no longer just a feeling in your chest while you meditate. Peace becomes love embodied in our institutions.
Okay, we have covered all this incredible high-level philosophy. We've talked about Maturana's legitimacy, Galtung's positive peace, McMurtry's life value test, the inversion of values. But how do you actually practice this on a Tuesday afternoon?
Right. Where does the rubber meet the road?
If I'm listening to this while driving to work, how do I make this real in my life? Thankfully, Dr. Sandley's paper provides a highly practical sevenfold grammar of spiritual coherence. It's a way to retune your life. Let's walk through these concepts, starting with the idea of constraint.
Constraint is the spiritual acceptance of finitude. It is the deep, humbling recognition that you are mortal, you are dependent, and you have limits.
Limits. We hate that word.
We do. You cannot do everything, you cannot consume everything, and you are vulnerable. In a culture that constantly preaches limitless growth, limitless hustle, and limitless potential, accepting constraint is a radical act. It is the antidote to the hubris that drives so much ecological and personal destruction.
And realizing your limits necessitates the next part of the grammar, which is margin. This is creating breathing room, grace, and rest. You cannot be compassionate if you are running on empty.
No, it's biologically impossible.
You cannot respond to a crisis with wisdom if your nervous system is completely fried. You have to actively build margins into your life, your schedule, and ideally, we need to build margins into our society, like living wages and mandatory time off. And once you have a little margin, you can look clearly at what the paper calls state.
State is the honest recognition of actual conditions. This is where we strip away the bypassing. What is the actual objective state of your body right now? Are you exhausted? What is the actual state of your relationships? Are they built on mutual respect or transactional use? What is the actual state of your local ecology?
You just have to be honest.
You have to tell the truth about where you are. You cannot navigate out of a maze if you refuse to admit you are lost.
And admitting you are lost usually comes with discomfort, which brings us to disturbance. This is huge. Instead of trying to instantly numb out, take a pill, or suppress pain, This is about listening to suffering, grief, and interruption as vital signals of miscoupling.
This changes everything about how we view pain. Suffering is a signal, not a sentence. If you feel deep, chronic anxiety, maybe it's not a chemical imbalance. Maybe it's a signal that your work life is completely miscoupled from your biological need for rest and connection.
Or if a society is experiencing mass protests.
Right. It's a signal that structural life needs are unmet. You have to listen to the disturbance, not just silence it with a heavier police presence or a stronger antidepressant.
And listening to the disturbance requires perception. This is the discipline of seeing what actually serves life in the long run versus what just serves your ego, your convenience, or the status quo in the short term. Once you perceive what is needed, you move to regulation.
Regulation refers to the actual practices that restore coherence without relying on domination. Depending on the disturbance, regulation could be many different things. It could be prayer or meditation to regulate your own nervous system.
Or it could be political action to regulate a toxic corporation.
It could be taking a nap. It could be facilitating a restorative justice circle to repair a harm in the community. It is whatever action brings the organism and the world back into a life-serving relationship.
And finally, when you regulate the system, it opens up options. This is the goal, widening real life-serving futures. Freedom isn't just having 1,000 different brands of cereal to choose from in the supermarket. True freedom is the shared possibility of a life that flourishes. So I want to walk through a practical application of this. I want you to think of a current disturbance in your life right now. Maybe it's a bitter conflict with a family member or a chronic anxiety about your financial future.
Normally, if we are operating under the inverted lifeline spiritual instinct, our reaction might be to use a meditation app to just silence that anxiety. Or to tell ourselves good vibes, only to bypass the family conflict and avoid the difficult conversation. We try to erase the disturbance.
Exactly. But using the sevenfold grammar, you approach it completely differently. First, you accept the constraint. You admit, the situation is hard, I cannot force this other person to change, and I am stressed. Then you check your margin. Have I slept? Do I need a moment of grace or a walk around the block before I engage with this? Then you assess the state honestly. We are entirely disconnected right now, and my finances are genuinely precarious.
Right. Total honesty.
You listen to the disturbance. This tight feeling in my chest, this anxiety, is telling me that a fundamental boundary is being crossed or a basic need is threatened. You refine your perception. What would actually heal this? Winning the argument or finding mutual understanding, ignoring the bank statements or making a realistic budget.
Yeah.
Then you move to regulation. Maybe you initiate a difficult, honest, vulnerable conversation with that family member. Or you set a firm boundary. And that action, that regulation, opens new options. A more authentic relationship or a healthier environment where you aren't constantly triggered.
Notice how utilizing this grammar completely prevents spirituality from becoming reductive. It stops being about aesthetics. It's no longer about whether a practice looks spiritual. Sitting silently on a cushion in a monastery isn't inherently more spiritual than organizing a community garden, lobbying for clean water, or having a painfully honest conversation with your spouse.
That is so freeing to hear.
The only question that matters is whether the practice deepens your life-coherent participation in the world. Prayer, ritual, community service, practicing medicine, engaging in ecological repair, they all become practices of profound spiritual reattunement when they restore coherence between living beings and the world they inhabit.
It's an entirely different way of moving through the world.
Yeah.
We have covered a massive journey today. We started by diagnosing the great spiritual inversion where derivative abstractions and symbols are worshipped while the real living world burns. We move to reclaiming life itself as the sacred ground of all value, realizing that without the hardware of life, the software of meaning cannot run. We redefined love, moving it away from passive sentimentality and defining it as the rigorous relational domain of legitimacy and coexistence. We scaled peace up from mere inner calm to the civil commons, recognizing that our civic structures and institutions must pass the life value test. And finally, we learned a sevenfold grammar to actually practice this attunement in the messy reality of our daily lives.
It's a paradigm that completely shatters the artificial barrier we've built between the spiritual and the material, the sacred and the civic. The ultimate takeaway from Dr. Stafely's work is encapsulated in a simple yet profoundly demanding quote from the text. Spirituality becomes coherent only when reverence becomes responsibility.
Reverence becomes responsibility.
Reverence without responsibility is just sentimentality. It's feeling good while doing nothing. Responsibility without reverence is just duty without depth. It leads to bureaucratic burnout. We have to hold them together.
Which brings us to a final thought experiment for you to mull over as you go about your week. We didn't explicitly answer this today, but it builds on everything we've discussed, and it's something you have to answer for yourself. Look closely at the worlds you are conserving through your daily habits, your purchases, the way you speak to people, the way you vote, and your silent compliances. If your specific, individual way of living was suddenly scaled up to a civilizational level, would the Earth and its most vulnerable inhabitants survive it?
It's a chilling but necessary question. True spiritual awakening might just be the realization that you are the architect of the world someone else has to survive.
That brings us right back to where we started today, that lingering feeling of burnout. It's not just a battery running low. It is your operating system crying out for a world that actually makes sense. It is a vital disturbance, a signal that you are ready to stop worshiping the map and start tending to the forest. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Step out into this vulnerable, messy, beautiful world and participate.